ourselves are like little villages along the shores of a great river, for the great arterial river that flows out of the heart is for the preservation and the healing of the nations. So we have the heart and its structure. Now the heart structure is a septenary, for within it, as we are told in the book of Genesis, the spirits of Elohim moved upon the surface of the deep. The heart has its own hierarchy. It has its own agencies. It has its own angels and archangels and powers and principalities. It is a tremendous, mysterious structure. And it has to be administered through an infinite concatenation of supporting functions and factors. The mystery of the heart is something that we really think very little about unless something goes wrong with it. And then, probably more than in any other type of ailment, a kind of fear sets in upon us. Because only under those conditions do we really begin to understand what the heart means. And it is only in the failure of civilization, in its own adjustments, that we finally come to understand what the failure of love means. That all things are primarily sustained by a power which has as its primary purpose the survival and preservation of all that lives. So even in the heart of the smallest creature, or in some little vortex, which is equivalent to, in a primitive form, to the heart focus, we know that the part of man which is above the physical has its final pole and its final center in the body, in the apex of the left ventricle of the heart. Here it is the pacemaker. Here it is that mysterious thing which plays the melody of life. The heart is the basis of life, and the heart serves all life without discrimination. We may say it has its own internal discrimination, but it does not play favorites with any part of the body, but serves them all as the one power which gives them life and makes possible the continuance of their existence. So it is actually that which, in a sense, becomes the symbol or the presence of the divine in man. In the books of Hermes, it is written that the eternal power placed itself in the mysterious pyramid of the heart, and that the pyramid in Giza was an ancient mathematical formula to represent the heart of life. The wonderful Saptapana cave of initiation in Buddhism is the heart. And in mysticism, all illumination arises from the power that is seated in the heart. For illumination is life. And life, properly directed and normally expressed, is illumination. Now, the second great power of the human body is another factor. And this second factor is derived again from evolutionary processes. And this factor is the mind. And the mind is centered in the brain. And the brain is again one of the most marvelous symbolical instruments that we can possibly imagine. The brain is more or less constantly in action. And from it flows the river of life, which we call the spinal cord. And in turn, adds something else to the construction of the complete person. This something else that is added is the control of the body by the mind. It is through the mind that the person in the body is able to administer the life which is seated in the heart. Therefore, there has to be a complete cooperation between the heart and the mind. The heart gives the energy to the mind by which it lives. But the mind, in turn, has a function. The mind, in a sense, we might say, is an executive guarding and protecting the body. Now, the mind of the average individual is not exactly protective in all cases. There seems to be some problem arise here. We find that the mind is very much like an arrogant adolescent. The mind decides that it is running everything. It forgets the fact that if the heart stops for a minute, the empire of the mind falls apart. We do not realize, probably adequately in our interrelationships with other things, that the failure of love destroys thought. That once the mind is no longer cooperating, it is inevitably cutting itself off from its own supply. It has refused to recognize, as man refuses, that there is a divine power superior to thought. In Eastern philosophy, man is called Manas, the thinker. And the thinker is a very important part of this great economy. It is the thinker which would enable man to learn how to take care of his own body. It is the thinker that can give him dedications by means of which he takes the divine energy within him and uses it for the perfection of society. The mind also is capable of a gradual advancement of itself until through mysticism it is finally absorbed in illumination. And illumination itself is merely an aspect of the infinite divine love located in the heart. Actually, therefore, the mind becomes a kind of prime minister. The mind is there because without mental controls, the body cannot serve its purposes. From the mind to the brain, therefore, there must be an adequate link. And this link is found by the study of the internal structure of the brain, where its ventricles, the ductless glands that are located there, and many other phases of it, of development, reveal the true mystery of the mind itself. For the mind is, as Aristotle says, is united to the body by an isthmus, this isthmus being the neck, which is the bridge between the mind and the body. And in the mind itself, there is the seat of what might be termed the initiate government. It is located as a servant of the heart. It is there to make certain that the life of the heart is interpreted into the integrity of the brain. The brain, of course, is only the shadow of the heart, of the mind, but it is a very important thing. Its various parts, its convolutions, and its ventricles, and all of the various faculty centers that are located there, gradually reveals to us the complete control which the mind can exercise over bodily function. But in order to do this, the mind itself and its body, the brain, by which we recognize the mind, must be understood. The purpose of the mind is not to create its own empire. But when a dictator in the individual, his own ego, decides to use the intellectual equipment merely to the advancement of his own purposes, he betrays its real purpose and betrays the body of which it is a part. So that the properly conditioned mind is the gentle and kindly and humble servant of life itself, and not a little tyrant or despot set up to enable one individual to be richer than another. We have the mind coming through the brain, and that part of the mind which is functioning in the material world is brain-centered, and from that must come wisdom. And wisdom is the power of the brain to interpret the life of the heart, to make sure that all things are fulfilled according to the law. It is the property and purpose of the brain to so control the conduct of the body that no discord can arise therein, nor can there be any discord between the individual brain and its mind background and any other brain anywhere in the world. Because there is one universal mind, and when it is broken up into individualities, then these often become competitive. But there is no more competition actually possible than it is possible for the brain itself to go against the dictates of the heart. If it does so, all is lost. The third great pole in the human body is the generative system. This is what has been placed here as what Plato calls the eighth power of the soul. This is the perpetuation of life. This is the means by means of which there is continuity. There is the fulfillment of a law for the providing of bodies to souls until their evolution in this plane of existence is finished. The generative power, therefore, to the ancients was always sacred, one of the most sacred of all powers. It was supposed to be founded in the power of the heart, which was infinite love life, supported, directed, controlled by the mind, which becomes, in a sense, the most direct factor in the reproductive structure. For the real drive of reproduction is located in the brain. The reproductive process, falling into abuse, falling into excess, becomes again an enemy just as serious as materialism is when it becomes the controlling power of the mind. The generative system perpetuates life. It creates the forms and bodies by means of which the invisible entities which come into manifestation find the open door into mortal life. When they come into this mortal life, they then call upon the other powers, because the mind as father and the heart as mother must not only in the case of the world, but in the case of the individual, must recognize a moral responsibility to life itself. We know all too well that the gradual decline of moral ethics is a tragedy, not only to world peace, world insights, world understanding, but to the healthy perpetuation of the race to which we belong. This type of problem reveals, therefore, in the human body a triune deity, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, a power of wisdom, strength, and beauty, a power to create, a power to rule and wisely govern that which is created, and a power to constantly improve the quality of creation. All these things are part of man's own structure. They're not something that was written in clouds on the sky or something. They are the daily experience of people. And in the presence of this, there seems to be a very great need for deeper understanding. Now, when we come to find that the body must be taken care of, and that these triune powers must have their own centers of function and must direct the manifestation of life, we then have the vital organs, which are distributed throughout the body. And perhaps one of the most important factors in this aspect of the subject is the process of nutrition. For all the parts of man's digestive and assimilative and excretory systems are parts of alchemy. Well, ultimately, we are going to find that alchemy and Kabbalah and all of these different phases of learning are merely symbolical of actual processes occurring within the human body. When we begin to appreciate this, we will have a new reason for the researching of these interesting and really very important fields. They are there to tell us a story. They are there to help us to understand something. In the process of nourishing the body, various elements combine. Some of these work through the magnetic field, such as the influence of planets and stars. Some work through the elementary atmosphere, the four elements of the ancients, and these produce certain elementary processes. Then we come down to the simple physical body of food. What is food? Food is life. And food is one great nutritional principle. When we take into our bodies various foods, they simply do not rush to one part of the body or another and set up abodes there. We don't have asparagus in one place and turnips in another. All of these food factors are passed through an alchemical transformation. The human system, particularly the digestive system, takes these faculties, takes these facilities, breaks them down to their essences, and in an essential form of life, then distributes them, so that we are not living off of cheese or macaroni. We are living off of a life principle that is present in all forms of nutritive material. All of this material is taken in, loses its own identity, and is transformed into a common substance that can be handled by the body. This is the most extraordinary form of alchemy that exists. For in this case, it takes food, which constitutes base elements, and transfers or transforms these foods into the spiritual gold by which life is sustained. So this part of the problem is very, very essential and very important. But it is necessary to part of the great economy of things. There are old diagrams in which the intestinal tract is corresponded to the mysterious underworlds of Dante's Inferno and Milton's Paradise Lost. This system of assimilation and finally the excretion of impurities comes in a sense under a purgatorial function. It is a mysterious realm in which what is not useful is discarded. Discarded by a wisdom and skill that the human being could not personally apply any more than he could control completely the function of his own heart. If we depended upon man to keep the heart beating, he would forget it sometime and die on the spot. But the control is in an area which he cannot dominate. He can influence it. He can influence it for better and for worse. He can discipline it in certain mystical exercises. He can change its beat, rate, but if he does so without great skill, he may disorganize the entire structure, because that which abides in the heart is wiser than can be given to it by the mind. So we also then come into other areas of which it is important to take consideration. The ancients were particularly influenced by the shape of man, and usually represented this form either in a cross or in a five-pointed star. The five-pointed star is the form we find most commonly shown in old Pythagorean researches. It represents the body with its five major points: the head, the two arms, and the two legs. This form was the basis of most of the cathedrals of Europe. And, of course, the cruciform, standing person with feet together and arms spread out, became the cross. And in the center of the cross was always the symbol of life itself. And in the cruciform temple, the altar is in the place where the heart is. For it is at the altar that the Eternal speaks through the oracles of wisdom. So the shape of the body became quite important. And it was also more or less considered very essential that the individual recognize the need for the complete cooperation of the two sides of his own body. These two sides, the right and the left, are known to the ancients and were studied and symbolically considered. And it was assumed that the right side of the body was for defense, and the left side for protection. The ancient Roman legionnaire carried his spear in the right hand and held his shield against the body with the left. We find discussions of this particular point in the Kabbalah, where the virtues, values, and problems involving the right and the left are very clearly set out. We also find them perpetuated in heraldry, where the two points or areas are of the greatest importance. Now, the problem of the hands, for example, or the feet, has to do with the manifestation of the individual in the daily activities and concerns of life. And it is obvious that we would be in very serious difficulty if any kind of political competition arose between these members. If we had a foot that was going in one direction and another foot that was going in the opposite direction, general progress would be hopelessly prevented. If we have two hands and one hand wishes to do one thing and the opposite hand wishes to do something else, which is incompatible or in contrary, we are in trouble. If we use the hands to knock someone down or to injure, this is a perversion of power. If we use the hands as a form of communication, as in the case of the deaf, they become very important means of carrying on a progress of some type of essential learning. The hands have many uses. Each finger has its own meaning. The feet have many uses and purposes. The lines of the hand have been the subject of a great deal of study, and in many instances it is obvious that they are very, very important. The problem, therefore, is that we have hands and feet, and these hands and feet have to work together. And in our material environment, hands and feet are symbolized by the machinery of productivity. The things that we have to do, the survival of the physical body in the presence of danger, transforms the hands and feet into legionnaires. They become the defenders of man. They become also the means for the expansion of his knowledge in many ways. And properly trained, they become magnificent instruments of the arts. And where they are there to guide us skillfully and physically through the problems of life, they have their part, and they are under mental control. Where, however, they give us great music, great art, wonderful appreciations for things, give us the opportunity to reveal from within ourselves something of the beauty that is there, then they are directly under the influence of the heart. And it is beauty, finally, that must redeem the rest. So we have in the body all kinds of interesting and more or less remarkable lessons. We find all types of processes, stress processes, mending processes, the constant replenishment of the body, the fact that it is one body, but that the life within it is manifold. And the individual, it has been said, and probably quite correctly, that by the end of a 7-year period, every cell in the human body has been changed. In the course of 100 years, every embodiment of man in the world is changed completely. Therefore, the continuity of the body depends upon the constant perpetuation of the life centers within it. Blood must reproduce itself, or we must have leukemia. We must have reproduction of the cells in every bone, in every muscle, in every nerve, or the structure falls apart. And this is where the principle of generation becomes very important. For generation is not only the reproduction of the species, it is the reproduction of the life units within the individual. He has to be constantly rebuilding. And when the body ceases to rebuild, then life has passed its peak. We cannot continue and go on any further. Now, the body also contains the polarities of the sensory perceptions. These sensory perceptions in themselves are very important. Man, in his evolution over thousands, millions of years, has developed one by one the sensory perceptions as the environmental condition made them necessary. As soon as there was something to see, man could see it. As soon as there was something to hear, he could hear it. And every type of the sensory perception was geared to a purpose and to a value and to a need. Today, probably our most important sensory function is sight, which was the last to come to us and has been variously specialized in different kingdoms of nature. Sight to us is the ability to look out of a window. Now, actually, of course, we think we're looking out, but actually, the sight factor is not in the eye, but in the brain. But sight has given us a tremendous area of educational opportunity. It has made possible for us to be observers of existence. It has made it possible for us to see what is going on around us. And then locked within the brain is another eye, the single eye, by which we see gradually what is going on within us. But at the moment, sight is largely located in the area of perception. But the brain has a faculty to balance this, and that is reflection. Everything seen stimulates interpretation, stimulates some form of moral, ethical, or spiritual truth. It makes it possible for us to observe both virtues and vices. It gives us the possibility to study the whole balance of nature. And by means of sight, the individual gains his greatest physical orientation, as far as he is capable of such orientation at the present time. But it is obvious that sight, as we know it, is not complete. It is also a known fact that the capacity of the brain has not yet been fully recognized. For the most part, we are thinking on the surface of the brain structure. But there is a dimension of depth to it, and the brain is capable of a vast improvement or vast extension of its own powers. But at the present moment, sight becomes almost a contact with the divine plan. We look around us, and we see things, and we like some of them, and we dislike others. We watch things created and beautiful. We watch things disintegrate and tear down and fail. These are all experiences of sight, but they are very important because to see the environment in which we exist is to be aware of it more acutely than by any other faculty. And therefore, it is the one great educator that we have among the sensory perceptions. It is the power to estimate. It builds into the brain mechanism the structure of discrimination, the structure of comparisons, and also it brings us in direct focus to the operations of cause and consequence. Cause and effect are probably more obvious to us through sight than through any other faculty that we possess. But all the faculties have their proper places and their proper endowments. Each one has a message. Each one is a messenger. Actually, we have given comparatively little attention to the evolution of sensory perceptions. We take them all for granted. We do not realize that they can be greatly improved. We do not try to balance them. We do not try to create a powerful cooperation between them. We simply accept them and are very little mindful of them unless they fail us. Then we suddenly find that some phase of life has been slowly taken away from us. So the sight centers, the sensory perceptions, and all these contacts are in a way the way in which the person becomes oriented, because the person becomes aware of things. Now, in the moment the five senses operate together and awareness is established, everything then depends upon the function of the mental coordinator. Because things seen can be nullified by attitudes. That which might in itself be important is disregarded by an indifferent mental mechanism. That which to the mind is not important can gain strange importance in the sensory perceptions, and sometimes this results in an extension of knowledge. But in all these different areas, the sensory perceptions have to be refined. They also have to be improved, and they must be brought into a cooperative relationship. Whereas today, no matter how many people look at the same thing, it looks different to all of them. This is due to limitations within the individual, and these limitations are artificial, because in reality, all things seen are the same when seen by all people. But immediately the sight factor itself is compromised by ulterior mental attitudes, so that we lose a great part of the virtue of these various sensory perceptions that have been so carefully and wisely developed. The body, therefore, does manifest through sensory function, and through this function gains a new and more complete perspective upon the circumstances under which the body is going to subsist for a time. All this together, and very, very much more, brings us to the final realization that this body is indeed a sacred thing, that it has been given to us for a reason, for a purpose. It has been bestowed upon us that we might grow, that we might improve, that we might strengthen our resolutions, and that most of all, we should be true to it, not to cater to it, but to preserve it in the best normal way that we can. In so doing, we will protect our own mental and emotional normalcy. But when the body is in pain and suffering, when irritation affects us, when we are debilitated or run down or in some way suffer from wrong nutrition, our whole capacity to live is impaired. It is very important, therefore, to recognize that we must bring the body into a cooperative relationship with life. And this, in a sense, is almost impossible unless we recognize the sacred factor, unless we realize that we are the living temples of the living God. We cannot, perhaps, have the courage or the strength to do as we should with the body. Also, it will help us, if we have this attitude, to realize that the divine will that is in the sanctum sanctorum of the temple, that is in the mysterious symbol above the high altar, that the divine will is instructing us, and that its revelations are coming to us through this body, and that this body, therefore, is indeed a truly sacred thing, that it is something that we should understand, that we should really come into harmony with, and that we should use it as it was intended. Well, there is no doubt in the world that while we are in the material world, part of our bodily function has to be related to material things. It is here, however, that that which is above the material must come through into the material, or our civilization can never survive. That which we give to the world from within ourselves must become, in part at least, what the world will become. And in these times when everything seems so extremely difficult, we have two consolations that we learn from the Bible, from the body. One is that there is with us at all times an available instruction in realities. We are forever in the presence of the thing as it is, whether we interpret it so or not. Whether we are able to live with it or not depends upon our own attitude towards the reality itself. If then, instead of going around this world as sort of little autocrats run by the mind, we could become the humble servants of the divine ruled by the heart. If we can humble ourselves and accept the leadership of reality, most of our problems will be solved. If we obey the simple commandments of integrity, if we truly learn to love one another, if we truly can take the various pressures and emotions of life and sublimate them into kindness, compassion, and can get over the idea of separateness and realize that one life ensouls us all, gradually we can build into our own lives a blessedness greater than we have known before. We also will find a purpose of our lives. We will find that no external circumstance can destroy that purpose so long as it is alive in our hearts. As long as the individual keeps the faith will keep him. But when he wanders away and uses all of these functions and faculties and the body itself merely to advance some small personal ambitions of his own, the real purpose of life is lost. The reason for our being here is lost. And we also build a barrier, because it seems to the average person that the ideals that he has, the dreams that he has, the hopes that he has, all of these are frustrated by conditions around him. This is not actually true. As long as the heart beats within the individual, he can be true to the realities of life. It is that which gives him life, and not his bank account or his stock holdings. That mysterious little point in the heart is the reason why he lives. And if he serves that mysterious point, it will be the reason why he experiences security in a troubled world. And as he experiences this, he will receive within it the final law which we have to find ways to enforce or to apply. And that is that the gradual unfoldment of the spiritual mystery within the heart overcomes the separateness of life. And we realize there is only one heart, and that heart is the heart of the divine. And that all other things, everywhere, that pulse is beating, simply because there is God in everything. And to understand that and to live according to it will overcome most of the discouragements due to a world that does not understand. We have the right to understand the world, even though it never understands us. Thank you.